Hey everybody, welcome to episode 11 of the I Heart Guitar podcast. Our guest today is Mr. Joe Satriani. Joe needs no damn introduction, you all know who he is. His new record is called What Happens Next, and it's out through Sony Music on January 12th. It's really cool. He's got Glenn Hughes and Chad Smith as his rhythm section on this one. And it kind of has a similar vibe to his record, The Extremist, which is one of my favorites. You know, it's got a really live, vibrant kind of rhythm section sound. And of course, Joe's incredibly, ridiculously great guitar playing. So this was a really good chat we had just the other day. And I hope you guys all pre-order the record and or buy it on release day and get this thing super high in the charts, because Joe deserves it. You know, he's been good to you. Come on, do him a favor. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this interview, and I will catch you guys at the end. I've been listening to the new record, of course, and my God, this one sounds like a lot of fun. It reminds me of The Extremist in that you've got a really powerful rhythm section, and it just sounds fun.
Yeah, this was a project that was supposed to be all about fun and having a great time celebrating my earliest rock and soul roots and applying everything, you know, that I've learned being a guitar player for almost 50 years. And I got real lucky that the people I reached out to were available and they were willing, and they came with great attitudes and just gave me fantastic performances. So obviously I'm talking about Chad Smith and Glenn Hughes, two tremendous people, and they were just so great in the studio. I'd like to think that it couldn't have gone either way, but I know that Mike Fraser is so talented at capturing magic, and that's what he did. He was able to capture all the good vibes and magic that we were putting out together as a trio.
Yeah. Well, I think people forget the fact that Glenn is a monster bass player, and he just has that, you know, funky, soul-y kind of groove. And, you know, he's worked with Chad for a million years, so this makes perfect sense.
Yeah, you know, I originally thought about Chad because we had played a couple of Chickenfoot shows, so they were one-offs, sort of in between my Shockwave Supernova tour, and it just made such an impression on me. It sort of woke something up inside of me, and I thought, I got to get Chad to in the studio and make an instrumental record. But how am I going to do that? Because I the key is going to be to pair him up with somebody equally special and that it understands where it is I'm going to be coming from on this record. And one of my favorite bass players of all time was Glenn Hughes, and I always thought, kind of like what you just said, that he doesn't get enough credit for being this monster bass.
Hello, are you there?
Hey, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you just dropped off for a second. Yep, hello. Yeah.
When you hang out with Glenn, you realize there's no separation between his personality, his singing, his bass playing. He's just 100%, you know, Glenn Hughes, creative musician. And it's really amazing to just see it and to play with him, because he's just always giving, you know what I mean? As the creativity is pouring forth, it's always natural, and he goes right to the edge, and he just gives you everything he's got. And I knew, of course, that he had recorded a lot with Chad. So, you know, when I reached out to Chad, I said, I think my message was, crazy idea, you, me, Glenn Hughes, instrumental album, rock and soul. And that was it. And he responded right away saying, yes, let's do it. You know, so once we got our schedules figured out, it was smooth sailing from there. We had a great time.
Yeah. It's funny. One word that always seems to come up with you in interviews is crazy. And I've always wondered if that's, if you are consciously trying to do things unexpected, or if they just pop into your head and you're like, oh yeah, I've got to do that. You know, do you search for these things, or do they just hit you?
I think it's a combination. I think it's hard to know, really. I'm well aware that, you know, our memories sort of rewrite things as we go along, and you think that, you know, that it was your, you know, that it was your fantastic idea that you worked hard at, but actually it may have been just something that popped into your head. And the way our memories sort of revise history, you know, you begin to believe that you had planned it all out. But I think it came from just a gut feeling that I needed to change. I needed to put myself into a new position, and I knew that that meant leaving a lot of things behind. And, you know, for an artist, it seems extremely tumultuous and crazy. From the outside looking in, it might look like someone is just changing slightly. But all I know is that my reality as an artist means that to change direction is always going to be cathartic. And so this particular time, it was enhanced by the fact that as I was dreaming about this, I turned 60, and my son was out on tour with us filming a documentary that turned into be about the whole creative catharsis itself. And it brought more of it out of me, I suppose. It intensified that. So by the time I hit the studio, I really did feel like I was either reinventing or going back to the earliest version of myself. Either way, it was the atmosphere was just filled with excitement, and I was just really charged with this new energy, and knowing that I had these new songs and I had these new guys to play with, and we were going to a new location. You know, it was hard to leave Skywalker, but playing, you know, recording in the legendary Sunset Sound in Los Angeles was a great idea. Yeah, although it was born out of catastrophe, because schedules were changing so quickly, it turned out to be that added little piece of energy that really made those sessions work.
Yeah. I find it really intriguing that I know that you've there have been projects in the past where you've kind of just let them go and start it again, and that must be a really cathartic thing. I'm always just, yeah, kind of intrigued by the whole just letting it go, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's you know, there's all sorts of bravery in being an artist, you know. I mean, first of all, it's a crazy thing to do, you know, to pick up a paintbrush and decide to paint something that you think people are going to want to look at. And the same thing is when you're playing music. There's actually no intellectual reason to do anything, really, when it comes to it. So you have to have this sort of blind faith that this expression, it needs to be expressed, and it's worth something to somebody somewhere, maybe not right away, you know, maybe not tomorrow, maybe next year, maybe 10 years from now. So the whole thing is crazy, and but it's exciting, and I love it. I've lived that way as long as I can remember. That's all I've ever done, is this crazy thing of either drawing or making music, and it puts me on stage in front of people, which, you know, scares the crap out of me, and so it's really funny. I mean, there's contradictions, and there's true artistic yearning that's all kind of wrapped up in this confusing personality of mine. But one thing's for sure is when you know something's wrong, you know, you just have to walk away from it and trust that it's only going to be worth something if you totally believe in it. That you can't sell it to somebody if it's a lie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's the way I've always done it. I've always thought, you know, screw the money. If it's not right, just don't release it and do it again. And, you know, I do the same thing when I'm painting. I'm a terrible painter, but there have been plenty of times where I really thought that what I was set out to do was the right thing on the canvas. And then 2 days later, I go, you know what? I think I need to just cover this whole thing with black and start over again. And it's liberating, you know, to just admit defeat and start from scratch. It's a great artistic liberating moment. And you've got to learn how to do that, I think, to be a successful artist.
Yeah. It's such a mental game. I know when I had the opportunity to jam with you at the Thump Music Clinic a few years ago, I mean, okay, it's not natural to stand up on stage next to Joe Satriani and play guitar, but I told myself that it was. You know, I've been playing along to your record since I was, you know, 12 years old, and so I convinced myself in the moment, this is just normal. I do this all the time. I had no nerves whatsoever, even in front of that crowd of guitar players with their arms crossed, kind of thinking, that bastard. but then in the car on the way home, I freaked out. I was like, I can't believe I did that. And, you know, I think it's just so important to, like, psych yourself into stuff, even if you, you know, think you can't. It's amazing what you can achieve when you just let yourself do it.
Yes, yeah. That was Melbourne, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that was fun. I mean, who knows? You know, I think when you take that one step on stage, you really do have to kind of, you know, not think about or not project what you think the outcome is going to be. Mm. You can't actually be interesting and natural to people if you're being judgmental at the same time. You just need to surrender to the moment, which you did, which was great. So, yeah, it's perfectly normal to reflect on the way home, which is great. But it's better when you're on stage not to do any reflection. Just do it. Just be in the present and the trust that you've practiced enough in your life and you know, whatever comes out will be great.
Yeah. Now, a few songs on the record I want to talk about because, like, Catbot is an instant classic. You know, what the heck is going on in that thing? The sounds are amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I that song started with me writing on the keyboard. I was using this strange patch in the Absinthe software synth folder. I think it was called Manifold something or other. I had this idea, you know, about a cat, a robot cat, kind of like what a lot of Japanese people have, a lot of robotic pets, you know. And I was thinking, well, you know, what if you had one and it got out and it started walking down the street, sort of like John Travolta in the beginning of Saturday Night Fever, you know, kind of like walking with the beat of the music. And you know, what would the other cats think, the real ones? And then what would happen when the robot cat tried to communicate? And it was a silly idea, but it was a little daydream that got me to sort of fire up the Pro Tools and just start recording. So I played the whole song on keyboards. Then I sat back and I listened to it, and I thought, oh, this is really interesting, but it should be played on guitar. So that was really hard because I didn't play one riff the same way. So I had to go and very carefully memorize each of those keyboard riffs. And, you know, adding to the fact that I'm not like a real keyboard player. So it wasn't played very well. So I had to go in and sort of just memorize all these idiosyncrasies of my guitar playing. So what you're hearing most of the time is sort of the synth and the guitar sort of playing in unison as close as possible. Mm-hmm. And then the melody comes in, which was an afterthought, really. And for that I used, I had my, probably my JSMCO, the 2450, into a wah-wah pedal, into a Sans Amp plug-in, and then something called Sci-Fi. A Sci-Fi plugin, which has a way of degrading the sound and doing shifting octave regeneration in a very strange way. Like it almost doesn't matter what part of the guitar you play on; it just always generates the same sort of octave sounds. But I found that if I played a certain way into it, it really sounded like it was frying or burning up, you know. And I thought, well, this is great because it's kind of cat-like, but it's a robot cat, so it's going to sound bad, you know? And so that, I mean, you know, these things I get excited about. And then afterwards I sit back and I go, really? Like, what was I thinking? But there's a charm to it. And I was very happy when everybody loved that song and they wanted to record it. You know, you never know. You bring songs to a recording session and sometimes the band goes, ah, that, you know, we don't like that song, you know. But everybody loved it, and Chad loved the idea of, you know, playing a very tight, you know, sort of techno rhythm to it up until the big classic rock breakdown, you know. So, but that's what's going on with that one.
Yeah. I think it's so important to have, you know, some kind of a concept for songs beyond just listen to me play guitar, you know. Everything that really touches me because it's a song about, you know, an abstract concept or an emotion or something. And I listen to a lot of instrumental guitar music. I make a lot of it. And so much of it is like, listen to this cool riff. But I don't think that's a good enough reason to have a cool riff. It's got to be, listen to this cool riff that came about because of this thought, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, I agree 100%. I always write about something, some person, some event, some feeling, some fantasy that you have, whatever. But it's got to be about something. And, you know, that's a tradition that goes back more than history records. But if we look just a few years back, whether it's Coltrane, Miles Davis, or it's Beethoven playing Moonlight Sonata, they, you know, that's instrumental music. That was about something very important to them, and that's why that music still shines today.
Yeah. Another song that I really dig is Thunder High on the Mountain, because we basically, there's a section of that where it's basically Satch does Sabbath.
Oh, yes. So, you know, my earliest roots are playing Black Sabbath in my high school band. It's really funny when I think about it, you know, tight black jeans, black motorcycle boots, black T-shirt, hair covering my face. And you know, I had a big muff, an early Electro-Harmonics big muff, and a bunch of ragtag bunch of amplifiers. But that's what we would play. We would play music from the first three or four Sabbath records, and that was the sound of my youth, you know. So it's so easy for me to write a song where the chorus is just chords, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm 39 now, and Sabbath was the music of my youth too. You know, I discovered them in like 91 or 92 or something. My dad never listened to them or anything like that. But for me, that was like early high school. Was just Sabbath and Zeppelin and Van Halen and you and, you know. But, I don't know, Sabbath seems to just continually regenerate new fans. I mean, I took my son to see them last year when he was 10 years old, and, you know, he's way into it.
Yeah, it's just music done right. I mean, you can't argue with it. And when it came on, you know, it was really odd. You know, which is something that came up. I've been doing a lot of interviews today, and people ask a lot about advice about how to get ahead and everything. And I keep reminding everybody that most of these artists that come about that stick around for decades and decades were really strange when they entered the scene. You know, they had a lot of detractors, and it took a while for people to figure them out. But, you know, just like people tried to dismiss AC/DC. Look what happened. And Sabbath is the same way. They came on and people were all upset about the, you know, devil music and who knows what. But as a young kid, when they came on the scene, I was the perfect age and I loved it. And I couldn't understand why parents didn't like it or what they were afraid of. To me, it seemed quite innocent. It was just really good blues-based heavy metal music, you know. And that we weren't afraid of Ozzy Osbourne at all. Only parents were.
Well, I really wanted to get I really wanted to get into Megadeth when I was a teenager, because like early teenager, because that just sounded like a cool name. But my parents wouldn't let me listen to them because of the name. So Guitar World did a transcription of Hangar 18, and I'm like, okay, I've never heard this song, but I'm going to try and learn it. So at least I can somehow hear Megadeth, even if it's me playing it. And then I was like, Mom, listen to this. And she's like, oh, wow, that's really good. And I'm like, in your face, that's Megadeth. Now I can listen to them.
That will always repeat itself, you know, generation after generation. Every generation needs its own sound, and it always confounds the generation before, you know.
Yeah. That looks like we only had 20 minutes, right?
Yes. Yeah. I got to jump for another interview.
in a few minutes.
Cool. Well, that should do it. Thanks so much for your time. It's been great to talk again, and I love the record. I'm so excited about it, and I hope to see you in Australia again soon.
I hope so, Peter. Thank you. Thanks for doing the interview.
Cheers. Catch you soon.
Thanks for the chat, Joe, and thanks to all of you for listening. The song that you are hearing in the background here is Energy, which is the first track of Shockwave Supernova. That was the last record. Is Energy, which is the first track of What Happens Next, Joe's new album. You can pre-order the record at Joe's website or on iTunes and all that kind of stuff. And please contribute to my Patreon if you have a few bucks to spare, or just retweet a podcast episode or whatever you can do to spread the word is always hugely appreciated. It's not exactly lucrative to be a freelancer these days, so every cent helps. Anyway, you can check out my writing in Australian Guitar Magazine, Mixdown, Beat, iHeartGuitar, of course. And I will catch you guys around. Bye.